Hey everyone, welcome to Garden Fork Radio. You're here with Eric and Rick. Hey, sir.
Hey, good morning, Eric. How are you?
I'm great. It's raining here. We did not have the super moon, but it's good to hear your voice, sir.
Well, thank you. It's good to hear your voice. We didn't have super moon either. It's not raining, but it's been cloudy. There's some spectacular pictures online, though, of the super moon.
I saw that. Today we're going to be talking about the super moon, some fall gardening stuff, how to tilt your sailboat under a bridge, and Brussels sprouts.
Sounds good.
For everyone that's your first time listening here, Garden Fork is a eclectic DIY podcast. It's kind of whatever's in Eric's brain we talk about every week. And I also have a YouTube channel with the videos on it as well. And welcome if you're your first time here. If you're a regular listener, I appreciate that too. There's the numbers have been going up slowly because I've realized that if I post podcasts regularly, more people will listen. Huh?
See, it reminds them about the videos.
Yeah.
By the way, I liked your video on all the leaf mulching you were doing. That is one of my favorite fall things, is to let my industrious neighbors gather all their leaves in the sacks, and then I go around, pick them up, run the mulching mower over them, and put them into a pen, and they come into a nice mulch in a year or so.
What I've been doing is, Troy Bilt gave me this giant mower. It's called the Flex, and it has a much wider deck than my push mower does.
I am envious of that, by the way.
And I just blow it right through the leaves, and I got to go through it a couple times. It's not magic. They do have a chipper shredder that's pretty magical. But I've been taking the leaves, and I put them on my raised beds. The raised beds that are going to be fallow for the winter, and then I put black plastic on top of the mulched leaves.
Why do you do that?
Well, my thinking is it's a double layer to keep weeds from sprouting in the spring.
Yeah.
I know in the fall that the worms come up a little bit and pull down some of that leaf matter into the soil. And in the spring, the black plastic helps the raised bed warm up faster. The soil warms up faster. And then I can just pull off the black plastic and I can plant right through the leaf mulch. You know, I can put my tomatoes in or eggplants or stuff. You can't plant rows of seeds through leaf mulch, but if you've got transplants, it works really great. Just leave the leaf mulch right on there and go right through it.
Oh, sounds like a plan.
I think it also helps with that. You know, we've been talking about the tomato funguses and blights that splash from the dirt up on the leaves. If you don't want to use plastic, you could use the shredded leaf mulch. And I don't know if it does exactly the same thing, but it might help.
Yeah, see, I need to get out there and get my tomatoes out of the ground. We've had our first freeze the other night. But I've been so darn busy with a photo project that I took on. You're right. Wedding photography is a thankless job. But I got it all done. And so now I get to get back to the yard work. Did you see my Brussels sprout, my big spike of Brussels sprouts?
I did. Did you grow that or buy that?
I grew that.
Okay, sorry. I couldn't quite tell from the photo. And that was on the Facebook group?
That was on the Facebook group, the, what do we call it, Garden Fork Q&A?
Yeah.
And anyone can join. It's a closed group only so we can make sure the spammers don't get in there. But sign up for it, and we'll check you out real quick and then get you hooked up with it. But anyway, most people have never really seen a stalk, a Brussels sprout with little brains stuck all around the edges of it.
Yeah, it usually comes in a bag of frozen Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, and it's the last one I'll be growing, I can tell you that. They are they're in the cabbage family, of course, and I had one heck of a problem with cabbage butterflies and then cabbage worms and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Trying to grow that. I finally sheathed it in a one leg of pantyhose to keep everything away from it and tied it down at the bottom.
Wow.
But I still ended up using a little bit of seven dust to clean it up some. But we had it last night. Wash it real good. Then I lopped the Brussels sprouts off of the stalk and cut them in half, rolled them in a little bit of EVOO and oil or salt, And then put them face up in a pan and the oven 350 uncovered for about an hour. And they came out so nut-like and just very flavorful and not mushy. They were crunchy. It was a great meal. And then a little bit of drizzled some balsamic vinegar over it.
So it tasted like green walnuts, you know?
Yeah, kind of, really.
That's interesting. I actually was thinking, I was wondering whether you had roasted the whole stock or not, whether you could just stick that in the oven.
People do that. It just seemed like a lot of trouble. And, you know, you have to still have to get the Brussels sprouts off the stalk. Now, a lot of people will cut the stalk down the middle, and that pulp in the center is pretty good to eat as well.
I think a lot of people's issues with Brussels sprouts is that they've had Brussels sprouts that are kind of old.
Right.
And they have a, you know, that's in the cabbage family, so it can have a bit of a sulfurous kind of odor or taste to them if they're not done right. And also if they're older, I think the flavor is not nearly as good.
It's true. And a lot of people have only eaten Brussels sprouts that have just been boiled to death. And, you know, if you boil it into a kind of mushy pulp, it's not going to be very inviting, enticing to eat.
I think the frozen ones are the way to go for a lot of people because they're flash frozen. I wouldn't say right on the farm, but pretty darn close, you know?
Right. That's kind of what I'm going to do from here on out. This was just, it was nice to do it once to get, I got one good stalk and I got several very bad stalks. And that's going to be it for me. I'll just let the professionals grow the Brussels sprouts.
Yeah. I got all my garlic in, so that was good.
That's great.
I got the spacing messed up a little bit, so my lines are going to be a little curvy in the bed, but I don't think anyone will mind too much. The garlic won't mind.
I was going to say garlic won't mind. The dogs won't mind.
No. No, they don't care about the garlic. So, but that is where I also use the leaf mulch there. People are really big in the mulching garlic for some reason, and I put on a little bit for the winter, and then when they sprout up, I put more around the stalks to keep the weeds down. But I don't use straw, and some people accidentally use hay, and that's a big oops.
That's a big oops. Hay, if you don't know the difference, hay has the seed head on it, and it will sprout in your bed, and it just makes a real mess.
So you have probably like a raised bed full of timothy grass.
Right. And be careful too about the bales that are sold around Halloween, particularly that are more for the display of you know, creating scenes in your yard and stuff. A lot of that hay, in my experience, has been treated with herbicide, and then it gets your plants.
Oh, did not know that.
Yeah. I had one, I think 3 years ago, a neighbor gave me their bale of hay that they'd gotten for their scarecrow thing at Halloween. And I should have known something was special about it. It was wrapped in plastic anyway, clear plastic. And I put it on my bed and it just killed everything.
Wow.
So only get it from the garden center.
There you go. All right. On a different note, what is the story with the supermoon?
Oh, well, the circle of the moon around the Earth, the orbit, is not
a perfect circle.
A perfect circle. It's oblong. And once a month, we're kind of close to it, a little closer, which is, what, perigee? And then when you're farther away, it's apogee. I think that's right. It's or the other way around. And we're just at a real close point right now. And also, it happened to be a full moon. So people... you know, have been kind of enthused about this. I think we're having three full moons in a row now that are going to be kind of super moonish. If you just go out and look straight up in the sky, you're not going to notice it. You need to have the moon down close to the horizon so you can compare it to things that are within your view. And it really looks impressive then. The higher in the sky it gets later at night, the less super it looks.
All right. Yeah, because it was cloudy last night, and it's raining this morning, so I did not get to see anything. I even went out. I was in the park here, which is on a bluff in Brooklyn, and you can have a really nice view, and I could not see it. So, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Moon. Yeah, We didn't have anything. I went out and looked at it a couple of nights ago as it was getting close. And I noticed then that, you know, when it's up high in the sky, it just looks like a moon. Doesn't seem super. You've got to get it down low and on the horizon so other things stick up around it, so you can really get an idea how big it is.
The spring on your microphone arm is thumping.
Well, that's because I hit it just now.
In case anyone's wondering, I'm not going to edit that out.
I talk with my hands while we're doing this.
And, oh, is that why that is?
Yeah, and every now and then I'll bang it.
We should have the video accompaniment to this.
Yeah. You know, when you said, when we were talking about the supermoon, I actually put my hand up in the air and made a circle with my thumb and forefinger to, you know, about how big I thought it might be. I just, when I talk with my hands. I do that all the time.
On a tangent here, I read about a satellite from the 1960s, early kind of satellite era, I guess. And It has started transmitting again.
Isn't that spooky?
Being dormant, you know?
Yeah, it's been dormant for decades.
American satellites started transmitting 46 years after being abandoned in 1967. It's from a site called Vintage News, which I've never heard about. I saw it on Twitter. It was a satellite designed and built by the Lincoln Laboratory at MIT between, one of a series built between 1965 and 76 for testing. And this one is the LES-3, I think it is. But anyway, there's a picture of it on the site here. It's called vintagenews.com. Just type in American satellite started transmitting, or we'll link to it. But it is very interesting. I wonder how many satellites were lofting a year now, but it seems like in the 60s they were putting up left and right, you know?
Yeah, but a lot of them were failing to make orbit. And that a lot of that LES series out of MIT did not make it into orbit. They came up short, or they blew up on somewhere between launch pad and orbit.
I'm really intrigued by people that are doing their own kind of homemade multi-stage rockets.
Oh, really?
I don't know if I would ever do it, but you know, I guess they're out. They have to be in somewhere that there's a lot of, maybe in the salt flats or the deserts or something, but man, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And then they strap their iPhone to it, you know, and you hope that it parachutes down. But yeah, there's some interesting stuff going on. Of course, in the big thing now are micro satellites, itty bitty ones. They release them in swarms. And they do certain kinds of testing or sensing. You can even occasionally ham radio operators will get together and build little satellites that they can buy a slot on the one of the rockets going up and launch a satellite for ham radio operators.
Wow.
So it's getting to be pretty junky up there, actually. There's a lot of stuff floating around in space.
Well, that's true, because the International Space Station, they have to, I don't know how many times a month they have to do it, but they have to move the thing out of the way of objects that are coming toward them and might punch a hole in the thing.
Right.
I wonder if you could go up there with a big magnet and clean up the geostationary orbit path, you know?
Somebody's going to have to think about doing something like that. Even if they can just tip them down into the atmosphere, and then most of them are so small they'd burn up and they'd just be pretty-looking meteors.
Wow. Wonder if people would pay us to do that. You know, we could charge countries to clean up space.
Yeah, so there'd be good room in their geosynchronous orbits for new satellites.
We'll wait for the price of scrap metal to go back up, and then we'll do that. So.
Okay. I heard you talking with your sister the other day. It's always good to hear her voice.
Yeah, it's good because I assume everyone knows everything, and she asks questions, and I'm like, well, of course, you know, why didn't anyone know that? But she has a generator, and their power went out in the middle of the summer heat wave.
Oh, dear. And she's over in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, and they, the power was out because it was this freak huge thunderstorm. And she had a generator. A neighbor gave her a generator for free, but it wouldn't start. And I was like, well, it's the carb. You know, I could, next time I come, I'll buy a carb and put it in. And then I hadn't done it. So I now have to, next trip out there, I have to put a carb in there. But make a good video. But it was just kind of a, I always think about cold weather and power outages, but she had to deal with very hot weather and power outages, which is a bit different. So.
Oh, yeah.
But the gist of it is fans work really well. And I'm going to make a video about this, about whether you should buy a stationary generator, a stationary standby generator, or a portable generator, and the pros and cons of both. But the biggest difference is the stationary on-demand generators are 10 times as more expensive.
Right. Although I have natural gas laid on here at the house, and you can get them for natural gas, and so you never have to go out and fill it up. They'll just run forever. So that's kind of a nice thought.
Right, but the big if there is if the station that pumps the natural gas through the lines fails as well.
I hadn't thought about that.
Well, the paranoid side of Eric thinks about these things.
Yeah.
The flip side is that, you know, portable generators are fairly inexpensive, and you need to rig them up safely, or you can just get a cord that plugs in to the generator, and you can have a bunch of what's called Edison plugs, you know, regular extension cord plugs, and you could run the air conditioner in your bedroom, and you could also run the refrigerator and stuff without having to hook up what's called a transfer panel to your breaker box.
So, right.
I guess there's three ways to do it. There's portable generator with some extension cords, portable generator hooked up to your breaker box, and then there is the on-demand standby generator gizmo.
Right. Well, you know, if you're going to hook it into your house electrical system, you know, please put in a transfer switch, because you don't want to be feeding your electricity down the line when the linemen come to repair the circuit.
Or I think I've told this story before, but a neighbor had a generator, and a buddy was like, oh, I'll make you up the cable to hook this into your house, and all you have to do is plug it into one of your outlets. And he wired from the 220 side of the generator into a regular extension cord that would plug into just a regular wall outlet. And the idea is you pump power back through the house that way, and you turn off the big circuit breaker switch at your line. But what he did was he wired 220 volt power into a 120 volt system. And so he fried their TV, their oven, their refrigerator, all their major appliances were fried because they pumped 220 volts into the house.
You know, the Navy did that to us when we were living in Annapolis. They tested their generator for the quarters we were living in, and they managed to somehow blow up almost everything. They bought us all new TVs and all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oops.
So yeah, when you live in quarters and they're taking care of that kind of stuff, they have to be careful.
Yeah. So on Facebook, you posted a video of a sailboat with a very tall mast that was trying to go underneath a bridge whose clearance was shorter than the mast height.
Right. And it's an interesting proposition. I think that is the railroad bridge that goes across the Okeechobee Waterway down in Florida. It's on the eastern end of the Okeechobee Lake Okeechobee. And it's not as difficult as it looks, but, you know, sailboats are meant to be heeled over anyway when the wind hits them. And so it's really just a matter in this case. I'm not sure where he got those bags that he was hanging off his main halyard from the top of the mast, but he got the boat tipped over far enough that he could slide underneath it. We did that when we came up the Intercoastal, and we were just a little bit too tall for that bridge. But there's a company that sits that's at the marina right there at the bridge that will come out and put plastic 55-gallon drums on your deck on one side or the other, and then pump water into them. And occasionally you have to hoist one up a little bit and heel the boat over. And then they'll use their boat as a yawl boat and just kind of push you under the bridge. This guy was really moving in that video.
It looked like there were these big bags that held water, and they had hoisted them to the top of the mast, and it tilted the ship over. It looked like a 30-degree angle or something.
Yeah, but I had some issues with how fast he was going, considering that was a very expensive boat, and he was headed under a bridge with pilings on either side. But it looks like he made it. But it's always interesting. And you know, for a sailor, it looks odd for other people. But for a sailor, you know, we do that kind of thing fairly often. In places that have good tidal current, we will run the boat up onto the beach at high tide, let the water drain out underneath it, and scrub down one side. It's called careening. And then when the tide comes in, it'll float the boat. You turn it over and then turn it around and then lay it over on the other side. As the tide goes out the next time, you clean the bottom on that side. And then when the tide comes in the third time, you take the boat off. So,
wow. I was impressed by the level of sailing knowledge that is in the Garden Fork Facebook group.
That's true. Aaron is a wealth of information.
Blew me away with what you guys were talking about, and I was just like, but I forget that she's been sailing since I think she was 4 years old, and right. She is a writer for Sailing Magazine, so it's like write her. That's her bailiwick. How's that for a sailing
yeah.
word?
Yeah, she's actually an editor.
Oh, sorry.
For the magazine, yeah, writer and editor.
Sorry, Aaron.
For the magazine, yeah.
She's yelling at the radio right now.
Yeah. Those two idiots, they don't know what they're talking about.
She'll be back on the show soon. So.
Good.
But I was just, I look at sailing and it's hasn't changed a whole lot. The basics of it haven't changed. And it seems like thousands of years. You put a piece of cloth up, attach it to a stick coming out of your boat, and you point it into the wind and it pushes you, you know?
Right. Or if you, you're going upwind, you actually form the sails into a wing and lift the boat, and you can sail about 45 degrees to the wind, you know, port or starboard, left or right, and go against the wind to a certain degree. And it's all about kind of zigzagging around and playing the wind and the water and the waves. To get to where you're going. I think it's a fascinating thing to be doing.
Yeah, you know, in your plywood boat, you just paddle.
So. You know, I was going to say, have you thought about putting sails in your plywood boat?
There are plywood boat plans that you can add a sail to, but I just don't know enough about sailing. I have a friend who belongs to a very DIY sailing club out. It's near the Rockaways. It's in Jamaica Bay Wildlife Refuge near Kennedy Airport. If any right. of you are familiar with that. And I keep wanting to go out there and see what they're up to because it looks like a fun bunch of people there. So they have sailboats, and then they built a wooden boat. But the irony is the first boat they built was a John boat, which has no sails.
Right.
It's for fishing for catfish, you know? And I'm like, you're in the ocean. But, you know, they wanted to do something. So what the heck?
Sure. Well, you know, the problem with plywood boats would be a keel, you know, coming up with a keel that's weighted enough. There's a process called duck boards, and they're like keels that you can put down on the left and right side or port and starboard of your boat, and to help counteract and balance the sail. So,
oh, I've seen those.
Yeah, and they use them a lot, particularly in tidal areas like on the Thames River. A lot of boats, you know, will sit in the mud flats when the tide goes out. And so they'll have these duck boards to kind of keep the boat from tipping over one way or the other. But it works pretty good for sailing. It's not great, but it's pretty good.
I've seen actually recently in the Times that they found some ancient boats in the bottom of the Black Sea.
You bet. Perfectly preserved. I think there are 41 of them. Some of them go back to before there was a written history of, or even an oral history, maybe of the period. And these boats are perfectly preserved. These ships really were perfectly preserved because of what happens in the Black Sea. There's no oxygen down there at the bottom. It's salty, and there's no oxygen, and so everything, even the lines and halyards, are perfectly preserved on these boats. Now, they're out about, what, I think 1,500, 2,000 feet, something like that. Am I wrong about that?
Yeah, they are. They're out there.
Yeah, they're way deep. And they're using remotely operated vehicles to explore them. But they say you can even see the tool marks in the wood on the ships. They're so perfectly preserved.
It's kind of amazing. If you go to the New York Times, I'll link to it, but they have some photos because they hired a ship that is usually used to inspect undersea oil installations, oil drilling installations, and they used photogrammetry to create 3D-like images of these boats, and it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
More than 40 shipwrecks. Neat, huh? And I'm looking at the pictures right now. Which you
yeah,
really you must,
I was going to say, yeah, I have my radio glasses on. I can see what you're seeing.
I'm holding it up to the microphone. Can't you all see? But it's in the Bulgarian side of the Black Sea. And now I think they're trying to figure out, they're going to have to work with some other countries to secure just a kind of an agreement about how to, I don't know if they want to salvage them or just discover them. But my whole point here is that some of them have those rudders on the side of the boat, the keels on the side of the boat, rather than underneath the boat.
Oh, duck boards. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because actually, I've seen perhaps from Egyptian pictures, engravings, boats that were on the Nile with these things sticking down the sides, and I never knew what those were. And now, because I'm talking with Rick about sailing, I know what that is.
See, just a wealth of information.
Yeah, I love it. All right, well, there you go.
Yeah, what else do you have to talk about today?
Well, I wanted to thank some recent Patreon supporters, but I can't figure out. I went onto my Patreon page and I can't sort by date for some reason. But the last time you were on, Rick, I forgot to mention Patreon, and then you talked it up a little bit, and three people signed on to be monthly contributors at Garden Fork because of you.
Oh, that's terrific. I'm glad to hear it. And thank all of you who do participate through Patreon. It's a very simple and easy way to manage your patronage of all kinds of different
creators.
Creators, yeah. And the money is predominantly goes directly to the creator. Of course, Patreon scrapes a little bit off the top. But it's a great way to control it. And I have set personally a Patreon budget, and some of the projects are actually my wife wants to watch or see, and some are mine. And sometimes it's just $1 or $2 a month, but that all adds up to a lot of people. And I have some that go up to $3 or $5 a month. And if things get too tight, you can actually cut back.
Yes, you can at any time.
And it's all in one place. And so you don't have to go chasing, your PayPal account over here for this outfit. And maybe you had some sort of withdrawal at another place. Patreon is really nice that it allows you to support people easily and support their creative endeavors. And I like the idea of it.
You know, Rick, I wanted to offer you entrance into the gold level program of the Garden Fork Patreon page, if you'd be interested in that.
So. Oh, well, yeah. What would I get for the gold level?
I'll let you be in the podcast again.
There is no gold level, right?
Rick has been a contributor forever. I think one of the first things is you bought the Labrador book.
I did. How'd you remember that?
Because I got you to give me a lot of money for that book.
Well, a short-run print edition like that of quality photos is pretty expensive to produce.
Yeah.
But it was really great to see the dogs.
There's two different, actually, Labrador books, which I will link to. I haven't talked about them in a while, but you can order them on demand from blurb.com. And they were fun to put together. I have to do that again. I'm wrestling with Lightroom and Adobe Bridge and just cataloging all the photos. I'm kind of angry at it. But anyway, but the flip side is because of the Patreon people that support Garden Fork, I was able to buy a second LED monitor to make editing easier and managing the website much easier as well. Because like I have 4 different blog posts about generators, and I was trying to fix them all last night so they all made sense and could link to each other, and some of them had outdated information. And I get, if I can't see it all at once, I get overwhelmed because I forget what looks like what. So with 2 monitors, I can have each page up on the screen and I can go, okay, this one works, this doesn't. So, and it was, I got it on Amazon. It's an HP monitor and it was $100. So
I'll
link to it. It works really well. I'll link to the specific model I got, but it's quite good. It's quite good. So thank you, everybody.
You bet. I forget his name. It's Kevin at Little Black Dogs.
Yeah, right? He's great.
Yeah, he turned me on to an outfit called OWC, Otherworld Computing, and they have some of the neatest things for your computers. I'm a Mac guy, but they have all kinds of things. One of them was a data doubler. A while back I put a solid state drive in, and then they make what they call a data doubler. You take out your optical drive, for your DVDs and CDs and whatnot, which didn't get much use on this computer. And I put in a 2 terabyte hard drive in its place. And then I bought an enclosure for the DVD player that came out of it, so I can plug it into a serial port or a USB port and use it when I need to. But I doubled the data, and it wasn't that expensive. I think it was maybe $110 or something to get the whole thing. So I'm busy increasing my speed and utility of my computer.
Huh. And that's at maxsales.com, I believe, is that
right? But it's Otherworld Computing, OWC.
But if you type OWC or One World Computing into the search engine, it all sorts of bizarro stuff shows up.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. Then it's Mac Sales. Yeah.
It's called Otherworld Computing. Yeah, they need to work on their branding a little bit. But yeah, Kevin is a great resource. Actually, I'll ask everyone a question. My second monitor, I have a HDMI to Thunderbolt, Lightning adapter to go into my iMac. And if the computer goes to sleep, when I wake up the computer, the second monitor stays black and the primary monitor on the iMac flashes. And if I click around enough, I think I can get it to stop sometimes. But I think the second monitor sleeps for a longer period than the first one. I'm not quite sure. But if Kevin or anyone has an idea about what that might be, I'm fully upgraded on operating system software. So radio@gardenfork.tv. So there you go.
I think it's busted.
I don't know.
I don't know. Okay, listen, I need to get out of here. The dogs need a walk, and it's kind of in between rain showers that are coming today. So I enjoyed talking with you, my friend.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Okay, talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from uniquetracks.com. Thank you.